This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Whether I'm worried about hosting or just giving that perfect gift, creating a delicious holiday for my loved ones is super important to me. From effortless holiday hostings to unforgettable gifts, Omaha Steaks delivers the world's best steak experience. They've always been super convenient in giving me the most high-quality steaks I could ask for, whether for myself or a loved one. Omaha Steaks offers unrivaled quality and variety, and every bite is backed by their 100% guarantee. Save big on gourmet gifts and more holiday favorites with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com, and for an extra $35 off, use code YUM at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code YUM. Go to omahasteaks.com and use code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details. A big thanks to our advertiser, Omaha Steaks.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. This is episode 154, Meet the Messy Neighbors. King Antiochus II is dead. He was never meant for the throne, but he fought a Syrian war, established a working peace, and even alliances with the petty kings of northern Anatolia. He granted greater and greater autonomy to the upper satrapies, and through it all was forced into a messy situation in his marriage. The Ptolemaic Berenike and her newborn child Antiochus officially usurped the position of Seleucid Queen Laodike and her sons, Seleucus and Antiochus Hierax. Many ancient historians speculated that Laodike poisoned Antiochus Theos for his trouble, and we left off with Theos's death and the stage set for feuding queens to take their frustrations out on the empire. Before we get to that, we should get caught up on the Seleucid neighbors. Right off the bat, there's not much new to cover east of the Mediterranean. I covered most of those neighbors to the extent that we know anything about them in episode 152 via their interactions with Antiochus. So today is going to be all about getting caught up on Ptolemaic Egypt, Antigonid Macedon, and Greece. Of course, those regions pop in and out of our main story all the time, but it's been a while since I really explained what's going on to the west. With a new Ptolemy, the third, just taking over in the last episode, and Antigonus Gonatas entering his final years, it's worth doing some quick catch-up work to understand the internal factors that contribute to their decision-making in Seleucid history. Of course, this is a single, relatively short episode. It's not going to be exhaustive. If you want a more detailed look into the other Hellenistic kingdoms, I cannot recommend Derek's The Hellenistic Age enough. He's been on this show a couple of times to talk about Hellenistic topics, and it is a much more thorough examination of the period between Alexander and Augustus as a whole than I am ever going to do with my narrow focus on the Seleucids. We are going to start with Macedon under King Antigonus II Gonatas, because it's both chronologically the better fit, and because it was frequently the most westward-facing of the Hellenistic kingdoms. Despite Egyptian territory technically extending a little further in that direction. This has a lot to do with the neighboring kingdom, in Epirus. I very briefly summarized some of Antigonus Gonatus's antics in a few of the Antiochus Soter episodes, but there was a lot of jumping in and out of the narrative, so we'll rewind to 277 BCE. Antigonus was just one of the many competitors for the Macedonian throne after the Gallic invasion that eventually gave us the Galatians in Asia. The support that Antigonus provided to the Greek defenders won him a lot of favor, especially after the other contenders in Macedon failed to do anything of note, but that did not win him the throne. Instead, Antigonus spent the years immediately before and after the Gauls arrived campaigning around the Macedonian periphery, gobbling up territory in Greece and Thrace while working his way in toward the Macedonian core. The big turning point came at the Battle of Lysimachia, when Antigonus defeated a massive Gallic raid and the last real vestige of the original invasion force. That marked him out as the savior of the Greek world, and it was also around that time that he married the Seleucid princess Phila, who soon gave birth to a son named Demetrius. This gave the impression of a stable Antigonid dynasty, despite their struggles up to that point, which was something none of the other contenders could claim. After getting support from Lysimachia and the surrounding region in Thrace, Antigonus marched headlong into a multi-sided Macedonian civil war, fighting at least four and possibly five rivals for the throne. There was Antipater, the nephew of the old Macedonian regent Cassander. There was Ptolemy Epigonos, the son of Lysimachus and Arsinoe II, more recently seen so desperate for a throne that he rebelled in Ephesus and sparked the Second Syrian War. There was Alexander, some sort of Antipatrid cousin, we think, probably. There was Aridaeus, who might be the same person as this new Alexander. We're not sure. They sort of sound like they're the same at some points in the timeline and different at others, according to our sources. Apparently, none of these competitions were particularly impressive battles, because surviving histories don't really discuss them. The one who actually turned out to be the biggest obstacle was a Macedonian noble, mostly unrelated to any of the existing royal families, named Apollodorus. He had taken control of a new city, Cassandreia, of course named for the regent Cassander. Like most new Hellenistic cities, it was actually an old city expanded on, which was previously known as Potidaea. Regardless, defeating all of the more legitimate competitors first meant that Antigonus had given Apollodorus time to dig in. Cassandreia was besieged for 10 full months before Antigonus made progress. Not by scaling the walls or crashing down the gates, but by sending a mercenary captain named Arminius to negotiate a truce under false pretenses. Tradition, honor, and sheer practicality generally dictated that an army would not attack during negotiations. After all, if you are negotiating, it meant that you did not want to fight anymore. Not attacking was just a show of good faith. Plus, the other side had one of your guys. Instead, 2,000 mercenaries ran up to the wall with ladders while they were temporarily undefended. These mercenaries climbed right up and took control of the city gates. Just like that, Antigonus had defeated all of his rivals and claimed Macedon in under a year of direct confrontation. Well, most of Macedon. No sooner had Antigonus defeated every would-be king in the country than another would-be king arrived on his doorstep. And unlike the relatively easy victories over the bottom-of-the-barrel Antipatrids and Ptolemy, this rival came with one of the most fearsome reputations and veteran armies in the Mediterranean world. Pyrrhus of Epirus returned to his kingdom in late 275. He had attempted to conquer a large chunk of Sicily after his last unsuccessful attempt to rule Macedon. Pyrrhus desperately wanted to go down in history as a great conqueror and a king. He had set his sights on Sicily and Italy, but Epirus and mercenaries alone weren't a strong enough base to actually make that conquest. They got bogged down in Sicily when the local city-states called on their own allies from the distant Phoenician colony in Carthage and the increasingly powerful Italian Republic called Rome. Especially when fighting Rome, Pyrrhus's army drove them from the battlefield several times, but at immense cost, which ultimately led to his name mostly being remembered in history for the Pyrrhic victory, a situation where you technically meet all the qualifications for winning, but at such a cost as to be worthless. By 275, Pyrrhus's forces were so drained in Sicily that they just went home, hoping to exploit an exhausted Macedon and finally get Pyrrhus on the throne of a powerful kingdom. Once there, he found a largely undefended Macedonian border. Many disaffected soldiers who had favored one of Antigonus's rivals, and no shortage of Gallic mercenaries looking for work. At the Battle of the Aous River, Pyrrhus's rapidly growing army surrounded Antigonus, and the famous old Epirote king called out to the Macedonian officer corps by name, prompting mass desertion, leaving the Antigonid inner circle to flee for their lives. Unfortunately for King Pyrrhus, he was frequently his own worst enemy, and when he used Gallic mercenaries to occupy the ancient Macedonian capital of Aigai, the Gauls looted the royal tombs, infuriating the populace. Pyrrhus also failed to press his advantage, stopping to consolidate power, while Antigonus still controlled most of the eastern ports. This stalemate dragged on for 2 full years, and rather than finishing off his primary local rival, Pyrrhus took his troops south to support the rebels in a Spartan civil war. The Argead Spartan king at the time, Arios I, was supporting an allied city in Crete. So Pyrrhus besieged Sparta itself, but not fast enough. Arminius, the same mercenary commander I mentioned earlier, led Antigonid forces to drive Pyrrhus away from Sparta, and Arius soon returned to join the Antigonids. The defeat at Sparta meant that Pyrrhus's mercenaries did not get paid, and his Macedonian troops were losing morale, leading to another wave of mass desertion. So naturally, Pyrrhus shoved himself into the middle of another Greek city-state's civil war. That is one per page in this script so far. Two oligarchs were vying for power in Argos, and one of them invited Pyrrhus to occupy the city and support him as the new Argive tyrant. Pyrrhus didn't arrive fast enough, and the Antigonid army caught up to them near modern Naplio. The Argive governing council almost negotiated a ceasefire before Pyrrhus's local allies opened the gates at night and let him enter the city anyway. But this is where it gets fun. Pyrrhus's war elephants didn't fit through the city gate, which gave the anti-Pyrrhic Argives just enough time to fortify their own defenses inside the city and get a messenger to Antigonus. Then they subjected the invaders to a grueling street-by-street fight for control of Argos. The Antigonid and Spartan allies arrived within a day and found the city gates open while Pyrrhus's forces were occupied fighting inside the city. And when I say open, I think they may mean removed from the city walls altogether to make room for the elephants, because eventually they did get inside. So the Antigonids marched in behind the Pyrrhic army, adding another side to this chaotic melee of ancient urban warfare. Pyrrhus's war elephants, now inside Argos, panicked and started rampaging down the city streets. One of them was killed and fell right in the middle of the main city gate, blocking the exit. In the chaos, Pyrrhus was supposedly knocked off of his horse when an old woman threw a floor tile at him, and he was ultimately killed by an Antigonid foot soldier while stumbling through the streets trying to get back to his guards. With that, everything settled down for a while. Antigonus had forged some alliances in southern Greece. Pyrrhus's son, Alexander II, became the new Epirote king, and the mercenaries mostly went home or were hired by the Antigonids and their Greek allies at the end of 272 BC. So let's turn briefly to Egypt. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. We're still in the reign of Ptolemy II Philadelphus at this point. And for most of the period we have been talking about in this episode, Ptolemy's primary concerns were all things we have talked about before. Antigonus's Pyrrhic War largely overlapped with the First Syrian War. So I'll skip over Ptolemy's Asiatic affairs and family drama in this episode. We've done that. One of the Egyptian developments I mentioned in those episodes, but didn't really get into, was a renewed focus on the Red Sea. Despite running along the entire eastern side of the country and providing easy maritime access to the valuable trade of Arabia and the Indian Ocean, the Red Sea is rarely a focus of Egyptian history. This isn't just a modern academic bias or the result of outside sources. Egypt, famously, has many of the world's best preserved written records. The thing is, there was just a lot of desert between the urban core along the Nile River and the Red Sea. Most of the powerful tribes and kingdoms along its shores were too far south to have much direct interaction with Egypt. They were also generally less populous and militarily powerful than European and Mesopotamian states to the north in the same time frame. So even when the Egyptians did interact directly with the people around the Red Sea, it just wasn't as dramatic. Instead, once every 1,000 years or so, an Egyptian ruler would get really invested in the Red Sea again, spend a lot of resources establishing new Egyptian outposts there, and that would carry the Egyptian presence along the coast to grow organically for a couple of centuries before a pharaoh remembered that they could get cool new imports without talking to a Babylonian. The last king to really take an interest in the Red Sea trade was Darius the Great, and even then, only sort of. Darius finally completed a project that generations of pharaohs had started and stopped over time, digging a canal from the Nile and jumping lake to lake until they reached the Gulf of Suez, connecting the Red Sea to the Mediterranean for the first time through a series of complex intermediary canals, rivers, and lakes. Of course, that benefited the Egyptians by increasing the amount of trade flowing through their land, but really, Darius was the one who completed the project because it was more practical for him to do it than a king who only ruled Egypt and the Levant. It wasn't that hard to get something from the Red Sea through Egypt and to Palestine or Phoenicia, but Darius wanted to transfer shipments from Iran to Anatolia, and going by sea was wildly faster than huge overland caravan routes. Unfortunately for everyone involved, this canal required constant maintenance on the Suez end to prevent silt from building up and closing the mouth of the canal. Frequent Egyptian revolts made that harder and harder. And during Egypt's brief independence from Artaxerxes II, the canal was probably intentionally allowed to seal itself, cutting off a potential invasion route. Now it had languished for decades, with much of Egypt's spare resource since Alexander the Great going toward the construction of Alexandria and refounding other cities along the Mediterranean as Greek polis. By the middle of the 3rd century, 130 years after it was last operational, Ptolemy II had the time, resources, and motivation to clear the canal and get trade and water flowing between the Mediterranean and Red Seas once again. He also expanded the small port at the mouth of the Great Canal and renamed it using a Hellenistic cheat code. It turns out, when both of your wives share the same name, you can name a city after both of them. So this city became Arsinoe. Ptolemy also established a city named for his mother, Berenike, on the eastern side of the Sinai near modern Aqaba. With the canal complete, Ptolemy dispatched 2 exploratory missions to remap the coasts, one sailing down the African side and the other sailing down the Arab side, with both identifying natural harbors that could be used as naval outposts or locations for new Greco-Egyptian cities. These outposts provided critical trade infrastructure, giving caravans from the southern Nile a firm destination and allowing Arab traders access to Egypt without having to go all the way north. There were many of these outposts, big and small, but the ones I want to draw extra attention to are Ampelone, Troglodytica, and Ptolemais Theron. Ampelone was the most distant colony, not just because it was extremely southern, but because Ampelone was actually established on the eastern coast of the Red Sea, near modern Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. By all indications, it was pretty small, but it gave Egypt direct access to inland Arab trade routes, including the southern end of their Nabataean allies' caravan trails, and those eastern Arab groups that traded directly with the Seleucids in the Persian Gulf. Berenike Troglodytica was a multi-purpose outpost. But first, its name. Yes, that is the word troglodyte. In modern English, troglodyte is usually a derogatory way to say someone or something is unintelligent and underdeveloped. But in ancient Greek, it just meant cave-goer, or in more common English phrasing, caveman. By most indications, there was a real African group in this area near the modern Egyptian-Sudanese border that formed the basis for Greek writing about the troglodyte people. Or at the very least, Ptolemaic settlers thought of the locals as the basis for those stories. It's not unreasonable to think that the local population did spend a lot of time in caves, whether or not they actually built their homes there, because the mountains around Berenike Troglodytica were full of semi-precious peridot that was mined for export. Having a stopping point this far south also allowed the Ptolemies to manage their trade, giving a more southern location for trade out of India and Mesopotamia to stop and transfer as much as possible to Egyptian merchants, making the whole process a little less expensive for everyone. Troglodytica also served as an important military outpost. It was far enough south that there were still significant North African elephant herds roaming wild, and this city was used as a base to hunt and capture them, both for ivory tusks and to tame as war elephants. The actual southernmost outpost was Ptolemais Theron, literally Ptolemais of the Hunt. And it was built exclusively as an elephant-gathering outpost, where units of the Egyptian army went to war with the local pachyderms, hunting the adults for ivory and capturing the young to train for battle. On one hand, Egypt was militarily fortunate to have a nearby native elephant population that could easily rival Seleucid imports from India. On the other hand, Indian elephants in the wild are a bit more open to human cooperation, and Indian trainers had centuries of experience behind their methods and which elephant populations they pulled those animals from. The North African elephants had none of this, and frequently proved to be harder to train and quicker to turn against their training than their eastern cousins. With all of these developments seemingly focused on circumventing the Seleucids and decreasing Ptolemaic dependence on the Mediterranean, it's a bit ironic that the next major event for both the Ptolemies and the Antigonids drew Ptolemy II's focus right back to the north, the Cremonidean War. Thanks to its Greek setting, we know a bit more about this conflict than we do about the Syrian wars before and after it, but it's still pretty sparsely documented as major wars in Greece go. After defeating Pyrrhus, Antigonus Gonatas was riding high. He had the support of the most powerful Hellenistic poleis and much of northern Greece. And, as a large and powerful kingdom, Macedon could simply sponsor their allies in cities where they faced backlash. Still, dealing with oligarchic councils, bickering aristocrats, or gods forbid a democratic assembly, was a hassle. It was much easier to support a single man to rule as the autocratic tyrant, and one by one, major cities across Greece slid under tyrannical rule backed by the Macedonian king. This consolidation of power in Greece worried Ptolemy Philadelphus, who was happily operating as the unchallenged naval power in the eastern Mediterranean. If Macedon got its affairs settled on land, there was a good chance that Antigonus would try to expand into the Aegean Islands. This wave of tyrannies also frustrated the traditional power players of southern Greece. Athens and Sparta. Welcome back, guys. To be fair, they were probably still powerful compared to other Greek city-states, but they were far removed from their classical greatness. They just hadn't fully accepted it yet. So Ptolemy made alliances with Arios in Sparta and the Athenian assembly helmed by a general named Cremonides. Cremonides then negotiated a good old-fashioned Athenian-Spartan alliance to declare war on his northern invaders, in this case, Antigonus. Antigonus promptly responded by reminding them that Athens was not a true power anymore. He marched his army south, entered Attica, and ran rampant, pillaging and destroying swaths of Athenian territory while the Macedonian navy blockaded the Piraeus. Only then did Ptolemy intervene, sending his fleet to break the blockade. This fleet was led by an admiral named Patroclus, who built forts around Attica and the Gulf of Salamis to ward off Macedonian attacks. Patroclus seems to have clashed with the Macedonian navy on a few occasions. However, Ptolemy never really authorized a direct invasion of Greece. He held his army back, preparing for the next Syrian war, even as his Greek allies drained Egypt's war chest. Athens was besieged for years. And when the Spartans crossed the Isthmus of Corinth to relieve their nominal allies, the Macedonian army turned them back twice, killing Arius himself in the Battle of Corinth, 265 BCE. His son, Acrotatus, took over as Sparta's new war king, and changed tactic, attacking the Antigonid allies in the Peloponnese, only to be killed himself while besieging Megalopolis. The rapid loss of two kings effectively knocked Sparta out of the war. The siege of Athens dragged on for so long that it seems Ptolemy did decide on a more significant force to fight on the ground. Unfortunately for him, those troops were on the naval fleet destroyed in the Battle of Kos just before the start of the Second Syrian War. With tensions mounting in Asia, Ptolemy brokered a quick peace and quietly supported the continued resistance to Macedon by funding a Corinthian revolt to keep Antigonus out of the Syrian conflict, and this revolt actually outlasted the fighting in the east. Of course, that now brings the Ptolemaic story up to 261, and another intersection with our main narrative at the Second Syrian War. But if you remember episode 151, then you remember that Ptolemy was probably doing something financial to keep Antigonus from providing direct support again. He did this by sponsoring Aratus, the tyrant of Sicyon, who had just ousted a pro-Antigonid leader. Sicyon promptly joined the Achaean League in the northern Peloponnese. Flush with Ptolemaic gold, Aratus led a new wave of resistance to Antigonid power. The Aetolian League, just across the Gulf of Corinth, joined this revolt, probably also receiving some money from Ptolemy. Then, Epirus got involved around 260. Peace with Epirus lasted 12 years before Alexander II invaded Macedon in conjunction with the Aetolian Greeks. Alexander was not his father. He still posed a significant threat to the Macedonian homeland just due to sheer proximity, but he wasn't a require-the-king's-personal-attention sort of threat. So Antigonus sent his then 14 or 15-year-old son Demetrius to deal with the Epirote invasion. History alone knows how much real control the prince had over his troops. There's a good chance that he just did whatever more experienced generals told him to. But being officially in command and defeating Alexander earned Demetrius a glowing reputation at home, and he followed that up by invading and occupying Epirus itself, forcing Alexander II into exile for most of his remaining days, while Demetrius married Alexander's daughter, Phthia. Unfortunately, we don't know much about the progress of this ongoing resistance in Greece, but apparently, Ptolemy III continued his father's support for the Achaean League, and in 243, the League assaulted Acrocorinth, the main fortification meant to keep them from crossing the isthmus into the rest of Greece. With a major Antigonid loss nearby, Corinth rebelled again while Aratus marched on to the nearby port of Lycaon, capturing 25 ships of the Antigonid navy. This massive loss is one of the key arteries for control over southern Greece, and it sparked a mass uprising, with many states of the Peloponnese joining the Achaean League, while Aratus and the army invaded Attica, trying to get Athens to join the revolt with no luck. Aratus eventually retreated, and the Achaean League began solidifying its place in the Peloponnese as a de facto counter to Macedon in the south. But we are getting ahead of ourselves. The fall of the Acrocorinth was 3 years after Antiochus Theos' death. I focused a lot on political events in this episode, because those are the events that really influenced how these two kingdoms interact with the Seleucids. But I do want to address some of the culture that emerged in Egypt and Greece during this period. The Antigonids did have a cultural impact on Greece, but their place in cultural history is more complicated. Gonatas was particularly fond of sponsoring philosophers, especially those from newly developed Socratic schools like the Stoics and Cynics. The underlying theme of most of the philosophies that Antigonus was drawn to is a concept called monism, the belief in a single source for everything in the universe. And many of them tended toward a goal of achieving enlightenment or happiness through logic and reasoning. Of course, different schools had different definitions of what was logical and what the monist source was, and what constituted happiness. Regardless, Antigonus's sponsorship of early philosophers in these schools helped contribute to the growth of these philosophical ideas. In the rest of Greece, Antigonid rule also influenced culture on a broad political and social level. Although Gonatas ruled after the height of New Comedy, this development in Greek theater was still characteristic of the Hellenistic period, tending toward slice-of-life stories almost comparable to modern situational comedy, and mythological burlesque shows. Characters leaned heavily into tropes, and any commentary on politics or current events was usually made in the form of exaggerated, veiled satire. A word which actually draws its origin from the aforementioned burlesque shows, called satyr plays. The shift on stage was directly related to the shift in Greek politics at the time. As powerful kings in Macedon, Egypt, and Syria vied for influence in the Aegean, they, like the Persians before them, found it much easier to deal with autocratic leaders rather than governing councils. So they backed local tyrants. Variations of governing bodies continued to exist in some states. Athens, naturally, frequently reverted to some version of classical democracy. But in general, Hellenistic kings supported Greek tyrants, gradually transitioning the region toward a system of petty dynasties and strongmen rather than the diversity of institutions that defined the classical period. The Roman historian Polybius claimed that Antigonus Gonatas contributed to this more than any single king, installing more tyrants in more cities than at any other time in Greek history. And this led to tighter control and more suspicion toward media that portrayed political commentary. Talking about cultural influences under Ptolemy II, on the other hand, risks devolving into an extra episode. So I will keep this very brief. With 42 years on the throne and being the first of his dynasty to actually grow up expecting to be pharaoh, Ptolemy II did a lot of work to define what Ptolemaic rule over Egypt would actually look like in the long run. His father had been a Macedonian governor who took over the country, but Philadelphus was the king of Egypt. Where Ptolemy I proclaimed himself a god, Ptolemy II took steps to integrate the whole dynasty into Egyptian religion, proclaiming himself and his sister Arsinoe II deities, and grafting their personal cult as rulers to the cult of Alexander the Great. He took this a step further and gave several of his siblings, children, and cousins their own dedicated priesthoods to enshrine the entire Ptolemaic family as living gods. He also established a festival called Ptolemaia to celebrate his father in the same style as native Egyptian deities mixed with some Greek flair. Philadelphus took the traditional system of Egyptian government, a sort of feudal and sort of imperial provincial system called the nomarchy, and organized it into a strict financial hierarchy. Egypt's typical territory was divided into 39 so-called nomes, with its leadership split between a minister of agriculture, finance, and land usage. These three acted as checks against one another in a chain of command founded on tax farming. The royal court established how much each nome owed them, and it was up to these three ministers to figure out how to most efficiently extract more than that amount of tax from their nomes. This began in the early 250s with a general survey of the whole kingdom, much like what Darius the Great had done 250 years earlier. Like Antigonus, Ptolemy also sponsored philosophers, but his interests seemed to lean more into research and the arts. Numerous poets found their home in Ptolemy Philadelphus's court, including many of the best preserved and most popular poets of the Hellenistic period. Ptolemy II also expanded the famous Library of Alexandria, turning it into the almost legendary center of learning and research for mathematics and astronomy, to history and religion. He sponsored the Egyptian priest Manetho and the Babylonian exile Berossus to write comprehensive histories of their homelands in Greek, making those stories accessible to Western audiences for the first time. He supposedly sponsored the local Jewish community in Alexandria, a group which he emancipated from slavery after the Judean revolt against Ptolemy I. And he asked these Jews to start translating their scripture into Greek as well. This ultimately laid the foundation for what became the Septuagint version of the Tanakh. And the Septuagint went on to become the foundational Old Testament version for much of Christianity. Ptolemy II also maintained a close relationship with Hieron, the newly installed king of Syracuse in Sicily. Hieron was a former general in Pyrrhus's army who stayed around when the Epirote king left, and he managed to seize control of one of the major centers of power on the island, probably with Ptolemaic funding. At the time, the king was looking to expand Egypt's influence further west as well as north and east. Hieron's first set of coins with his own portrait even seemed to have been minted in Egypt and then brought to Sicily. He traded extensively with Egypt, basing much of his own kingdom on Ptolemy II's policies, and poaching more than a few famous writers from Alexandria, including the mathematician Archimedes. Likewise, both Hieron and Ptolemy also cultivated a positive relationship with the Phoenician colony empire based in Carthage, the obvious candidate for any westbound trade agreement at the time. However, those relationships only went so far. Ptolemy II always prioritized his own conflict in the east over any western agreement. They were just more immediately threatening to Egyptian power. So when Hieron of Syracuse got involved in a conflict with the Mamertines, a band of Italian mercenaries who had taken over the city of Messana, north of Syracuse, and both sides called on their allies for aid, Ptolemy stayed out of it. After all, Syracuse didn't need him. They had the unassailable naval power of the West, Carthage, on their side. The Mamertines just had the Roman Republic, which, while formidable on land, didn't even have a navy when the conflict started in 264. The results surprised just about everyone in the Mediterranean. You see, the reason most of the surviving sources don't care about the Hellenistic events happening in this period, from the late 260s to the late 240s, is because a much, much more significant event in regional and world history was happening far to the west in Sicily and North Africa. The First Punic War between Rome and Carthage, a conflict which suddenly escalated Rome to the dominant power over Sicily, Sardinia, and Corsica, with the ironic exception of Syracuse, and made it a true naval force to be considered in later Hellenistic politics. But there are more famous podcasts for that, so we'll stop here and get ready to return to the Seleucids. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.